Hello everyone and welcome to Usual Disclaimer with Eleanor Neal, a true crime podcast where we crack open some of the most notorious cases in history. Given the topics that we'll be investigating, it goes without saying that this show comes with a content warning. The details can get a bit heavy and you might find some of the themes we discuss triggering. Listener discretion is strongly advised and check the description for some resources and further information. MSN was one of the earliest social media networks that allowed friends to stay connected no matter where they were. But as with any great new invention, soon we would see its dark side. People used the platform to discuss sinister and even criminal things, such is the case with this story, the murder of 18-year-old Kimberly Proctor. Her killers planned and fantasized about her murder over MSN long before they actually went through with it, and they even continued using the site afterwards to support their fake alibis. Today we're going to be discussing the case of the MSN killers. Before we get into the case, I want to give my usual disclaimer that I mean absolutely no disrespect to anyone that I talk about in this video. This video is for educational purposes, and everything that I'm about to say is just information that I have found on the internet and I'm compiling into one video. So today's case takes place in Canada, in a place called Langford in British Columbia. That's where Kimberly Proctor was born on January 1st, New Year's Day of 1992, to her parents Fred and Lucy. Langford was a very nice place for the Proctor family to be settling down and raising a family. It was very friendly, it was very safe, it was just very comfy and cozy. It was just a nice place. The Proctors were very happy there. They were a very, very happy family, and Kimberly grew up to be a very happy girl. She was very smiley. You know, one of those kids that's just always bouncing about, really positive. She was that kid. She was very fun-loving. She was very people-loving and very animal-loving. Oh my God, was she very animal-loving. She was such an empathetic person to a point where she would want to adopt every and any animal she saw. And in her house, they'd had one hell of a zoo over the years. They'd had rabbits, hamsters, guinea pigs, even like reptiles, lizards. Kim was just obsessed with animals. She loved them. And one day she dreamed of going on to work at an animal sanctuary as a job. She wanted to be surrounded by animals at all times. Kim was just a very loving and lovable person, and she seemed to have a very happy childhood at home. She had a very happy home life. But the same, unfortunately, can't be said about her school life. She experienced a lot of bullying from her peers, which always made her feel very isolated, very rejected, and that over a prolonged period of time is very damaging to children. And that's hard enough to deal with on its own, is bullying and not feeling accepted. But on top of that, Kim had the added struggle of having ADHD. And it really, really affected her studies. The way that hers particularly manifested was in a lot of anxiety. She would get very overstimulated in like big crowds and big groups of people. She found school very, very challenging. Just the concept of being in one big building with like hundreds of people every day was, it was a lot for Kim. And she also struggled a lot with the attention deficit side of ADHD. She was very easily distracted in class. She would lose focus quite a lot. As time was going on, this was getting even worse. It was getting to the point where Kim was barely even passing classes. She was getting in trouble a lot because she was so easily distracted and the teachers would tell her off. Everyone knew that something needed to be done. Her teachers, her parents, even Kim herself knew that she couldn't carry on this way. So her parents took her to a doctor about her ADHD, and she was prescribed some medication that was supposed to help her. She took it for a little while, but her parents said that it just zombied her out. She wasn't the same girl that she was before. She wasn't as bright and enthusiastic, and you know, she wasn't Kim. She was maybe a little bit easier to focus, but she wasn't Kim. And in all, it wasn't worth putting her on this medication that made her a shell of the woman that she once was. It wasn't an option for her to stay on this medication. So they began thinking about what they could do for plan B. And that was when the decision was made to move Kim out of that school and into a specialist school that could probably help her a lot more than her state school could. These specialist schools are for any kid that might need a little bit of extra attention or care. And that can mean something different for every child that goes to that school. For Kim, it's her ADHD. She needs a little bit more of the teacher's attention and their time to help her through things. There were other kids in there that struggled with behavioural issues, other kids that had like learning disabilities or even physical disabilities that meant that they couldn't, you know, flourish in a public school. And so there were so many people from all different walks of life in Kim's new school. Kim settled in pretty quickly at this new school. She was a friendly, nice girl, so naturally she got on with people quite well. But there was another group of kids in this school. I think I touched on it earlier when I said the kids with behavioural issues, but sometimes it even went beyond that. It was the violent kids, the aggressive kids, the ones that had outbursts and hurt other people. And so honestly, it was quite hard for Kim to navigate making friends in this new school, but she felt that she was doing a good job and she had, you know, a good couple of people around her at this point, and she felt confident in her schoolwork. Things were really looking up for her. So Kim's main friend group, we don't know absolutely everyone in this friend group. We kind of only really know the ones that are involved in this case. But from what I can tell, the core friend group, at least that we're going to be talking about today, was Kim and three boys, a boy named Zach, a boy named Cruz, and a boy named Cameron. We'll start with Cruz. He was a couple of years younger than Kim. Kim was about 18 when she was in this school, and Cruz was 16. He was one of the youngest in their friend group, but he was also kind of like the ringleader. He was the confident one, the cocky one, the one that kind of called the shots, and he was also one of those aforementioned bad kids. Well, it's actually really sad because Cruz came from a very bad home. He was neglected as a child. Both of his parents were neglectful of him, and he really didn't get everything he needed as he was growing up. And this is kind of a common theme throughout this case, where someone will grow up to be a bad person, but they have had a traumatic or terrible childhood, and it's that really sticky feeling between sympathy, and you also want to be like, I feel no sympathy for you at all. You are a horrible criminal. But yeah, just to warn you, that will be a common thing throughout this case. Cruz had quite a terrible childhood. He was neglected by both his parents, his father ended up walking out on them, and then it was just his mum from that point on, and she didn't look after him properly either. And as Cruz got older, he held a lot of resentment towards his mother, especially, and he became abusive to his own mother at the age of like 14, 15, 16. He was shouting at her, hitting her. He was regularly abusive with her. But actually, one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that Cruz's own father was a convicted murderer. It's an absolutely horrid story as well. His father was called Robert Desmond, and he, I think, kidnapped, raped, and murdered a 16-year-old girl named Cherish Oppenheim. He beat her to death, physically beat her to death with his own hands, and then left her body on the side of a road covered in rocks. And she was eventually found, just ditched on the side of this road. He was caught for murder very quickly after he committed this, and when Cruz was 7 years old, his father was jailed for murder. And he would write to Cruz from prison here and there, and Cruz would respond a little bit, but by the age of 12, he'd completely cut off his father. He hated his father for what he'd done to that girl. He hated that his father was a murderer. He thought he was disgusting. And so by the age of 12, he completely cut him off, no longer wrote any letters to him. That's it. His father was dead to him. And that's only one of the very many heinous things that Cruz's father has done. He came from a
very bad egg.
His dad was done for, like, robberies, multiple rapes, home invasions. This man just had no respect for anyone. And although he wasn't in Cruz's life for very long, up until the age of 7, you can imagine that that attitude and his reactions to things probably definitely rubbed off on his son. Everyone that ever met Cruz Wellwood said that he was a very rude and disrespectful and mean child, and not like in an oblivious kid way, you know, where they're a bit rude and they forget their manners and whatever just because they're a kid and they're busy being a kid. No, not Cruz. He was like intentionally a little asshole. He was very arrogant. He had delusions of grandeur over anyone and anything. He thought he was like the smartest, coolest shit to ever walk this earth, and everyone else was below him. In fact, the only other kid that could ever come close to Cruz, and even then it wasn't even close, but the only person that ever came close was his best friend, Cameron, who was also a part of Kim's friendship group. Cameron Moffat was a year older than Cruz, but a year younger than Kim. He was 17 years old, and he was also a bad kid, but he too had a very tragic backstory, a very tragic childhood. At the age of 3 years old, Cameron was sexually assaulted. His family said that ever since that incident, at the age of 3, Cameron had never been the same again. Ever since he was traumatized by this, he became what they described as a difficult child. And I suppose this is more so where that conflict of sympathy feeling comes in, because Cameron wasn't looked after. For this to have happened in the first place, and then in the aftermath of him dealing with the trauma of being sexually assaulted as a toddler, he didn't have help around him, really. But in that same breath, we need to acknowledge that trauma is not an excuse for treating people so heinously. So many people go through such traumatic things in their childhood and throughout their whole lives, and they never turn out like this. Trauma in your childhood does not have to lead to you being a murderer. You make that decision somewhere along the way. And trust me, Cruz and Cameron had made the decision to be shit people a long time ago. They were two little bullies. They were violent, they were aggressive, they would beat up other kids in school. One of them even beat up a kid with a bike chain, was like hitting him over the head with a bike chain, split his head open. They'd broken other kids' noses. They were just like always picking fights. They were those like insecure boys on the playground that were always looking to establish their dominance against anyone. And what didn't help was that the boys were often drunk. At 16 and 17 years old, they would find access to alcohol and drink it most days, sometimes even in school. They would drink so much to the point where Cruz actually got alcohol poisoning one night. He was sent to hospital and had to have, like, he was, like, hooked up to all them wires and everything. He had to be, like, flushed out. And it didn't even stop at alcohol. They were doing all kinds of other drugs as well. They would do, like, psychedelics, like LSD, and then they would do, like, synthetics, cocaine, ketamine. They would mix all of these things. It's so scary to hear how these boys were living at 16. They would often skip school to be able to drink and do drugs. Like, literally just 2 p.m. on a Tuesday, two boys doing MDMA in their houses while their parents are at work. Doing different substances really just took up most of these boys' free time. Well, whenever they were together in person, they were always on some sort of drug or drinking. But when they weren't together, they would be connected online. They would be messaging on MSN or on World of Warcraft. They both really liked World of Warcraft, and so they'd be doing the you know, the in-game messaging feature. Oh my god, I sound so old. I just don't do gaming, you know? But you know what? One thing about Cruz and Cameron, they really give me kind of like George and Lenny vibes from Of Mice and Men, but not quite so. So basically, Cruz was the smaller, younger leader with like his wits about him and all that. He's like the mastermind of everything. Cameron was supposedly the slower one of the two, but he was still, don't get me wrong, he was still aggressive, violent, and very much feeding in to all of this. So, That was Kimberly's friend group. I did mention a third boy, his name was Zach, but we don't know all that much about Zach. He doesn't come into play with this case all that much. But when Kimberly first moved to this school, she makes friends with these three boys, and she especially likes Zach. The two of them quickly started dating, but it really didn't last very long at all. After a few months, I think Zach broke it off with Kim. And Kim was pretty upset about this. I think this was like her first proper boyfriend, and so this was her first like proper breakup. She was really upset. She was going to all of her friends for comfort and advice, and that included Cruz and Cameron. And specifically Cameron Moffat decided to use this opportunity to get closer to Kim. He was gonna use her vulnerable state. She's upset. She's come to a friend for comfort. He was gonna use that to try and slide in and try and, you know, shoot his shot with Kim. After she has literally just broken up with one of his best friends, he is immediately trying it on with her. He was calling her beautiful, and one thing about Kim is that she was a little bit insecure, and so she starts, you know, like, kind of buffing off these things. She's like, oh no, I'm not beautiful. She would say, oh, I'm this, I'm that. She would be, like, quite mean about herself. And Cameron would be like, no, I haven't seen many beautiful things, but you're definitely one of them. What a weird way to say that, by the way. But honestly, Kim wasn't all that interested in Cameron Moffat. She was more interested in Cruz, and both of them were trying it on with her. Literally both of them. Zach is both of their friend. He just breaks up with his girlfriend, and they both blooming jump on her. So separately on MSN, Kim has a tab open with a chat with Cruz where he's flirting with her, and a chat with Cameron where he's flirting with her. And both boys were pretty relentless with it. Like, it was clear that they had been waiting for this opportunity to try it on with Kim. But actually, I say this, Cameron Moffat had been trying it with Kim even when she was still with Zach. Even when she was still dating one of his best friends, he was messaging her, inviting her to a party in his pants and stuff like that. It was crazy the way that he was talking to his best friend's girlfriend. He would text Kim euphemisms, you know, about this party in his pants, right? He would say that she's on the VIP guest list and it's just them two on it. He was so cringe, you'll actually throw up listening to all of this. He would also say that there was going to be candy at the party. There was going to be a lollipop with cream in it. And when you lick the lollipop, the cream would come out. It's gross listening to these like 17-year-olds flirt on MSN. And he was saying all of this to Kim while she was with Zach. So we're just taking it back a little bit to before they broke up. Cameron was relentless with the flirting throughout. He was saying all of this while she was still with Zach. And Kim doesn't really play along with it. I mean, this is her boyfriend's friend. So she's trying to like humour him but not play into it too much. So she'd be like, oh, what kind of party only has two people? You know, she's not completely rejecting him and turning him down. Because sometimes that's scary to do as a woman. You don't, especially when you know that he is quite a violent boy and he's been a bully to other kids in the school. And now all of a sudden he's like trying it on with you. That's just the joys of being a woman, isn't it? Sometimes you have to play along because you're scared. And I don't know if that's exactly what Kim was doing, but she was trying to like semi-humor him without playing into it too much. And Cameron was so relentless that in the end she did have to kind of put her foot down, and she was like, look, I'm not comfortable with how you're speaking to me. I don't know exactly how she worded it to him, but he didn't take it well. His response to her like actually asking him to stop for once was to blackmail her. Cameron threatened to send Zach the messages that they'd been sending each other earlier. You know, where he's like, come to a party in my pants. And she's like, what kind of party's only for two people? He threatened to send all of that to her boyfriend at the time. And Kim panicked. I don't know how the blackmail ended. I don't think he sent the chats to her boyfriend. I think it was a bit of an empty threat. And besides, Kim hadn't exactly like cheated on her boyfriend. So anyway, Cruz and Cameron would treat Kim as if she was like their designated girl in the group that they could just gawk over and, you know, treat a bit shit. That's kind of the vibe that I've gotten from all of this. The boys would relentlessly flirt with her, like I said, and they would be rather vulgar about it. They would just like straight up message her out of nowhere and ask for tit pics. And it's like, that's not respectful. That's especially not to someone that you call a friend, that you go into school every day and see and speak to and ask how their weekend was and all of that. But then when it comes to a sexual element in your relationship, you can't be respectful. You just tit pics, please. Barely even a please. Did they even say please? I don't know. I don't think so. Literally everyone in the school knew how weird Cameron and Cruz were at this point. Like, they made no attempt to mask their weirdness. The two of them would drink blood. They would drink each other's blood outside of school, and then they would come into school and like brag about it. They also bragged about drinking other bodily fluids. And I don't know what those fluids were. The articles that I read only said other bodily fluids, which makes it feel very rancid. There's not that many other bodily fluids to pick from, and they're all gross. So now that Kimberly's broken up with Zach and Cameron and Cruz are relentlessly in her DMs, she actually gives Cruz a bit of a chance. She'd always had like a little bit of a thing for him, but obviously preferred her boyfriend Zach. But now that that was over, she decided to feed into this little crush that she'd had on Cruz in the past. So I think the two of them went on a couple of dates, but it wasn't, they could both kind of tell that it wasn't going to be a thing. It wasn't really going to work out with them. Eventually Cruz broke up with her, but it was hardly even a breakup because they weren't together, and he hardly even broke up with her. It was just like all of a sudden one day he just started being really mean to her out of nowhere, just like absolutely horrible to her. Some of the messages that they would send to Kimberly were just so cruel. I've read through so many message transcripts as I've been researching for this video, and honestly, it was really like choking me up. I was like, how can this girl's two friends that she has trusted for months just turn on her and start speaking to her like this? They would, because they know her better than anyone, they knew all of her insecurities, they knew what really triggered and what really upset her, and they were intentionally going for those soft spots. And they would joke about her greatest insecurities, you know, her appearance and things like that, but they would do it in a semi-jokey way. So then when she was like, oh, stop it, like, it's upsetting me, they can be like, oh, it's just a joke, you can't take a joke. Oh. There was one particularly really bad, like, period of this bullying, I guess, call it what it is, it was bullying towards Kim. There was one really bad period where her rabbit had just died, and the boys really used this to get to her. Of course, it was a weak spot of hers at this point in time. And they would say things like, your rabbit deserved to die, you deserve nothing, you killed it. They would taunt her, telling her that she had killed her own rabbit. She was the reason that her own beloved pet was dead. And Kim was way too nice with these boys all the way through this. Like, as I was reading the message transcripts, I so badly wanted her to, like, fight her corner. But she would just take all of this abuse from them. The most that she would do to stick up for herself was ask them why they were being so mean to her. And to this, they would have a different response, like, every single time. There were so many reasons why they were so mean to her. One time, one particular transcript that I read, she'd messaged this to Cruz on MSN, said, why are you always so mean to me? And he didn't respond, and so she messaged again saying, well, are you gonna answer? And he finally responded then, saying, I was talking to someone more important than you. Honestly, I don't care enough to pick on you. If I was picking on you, I would have torn you apart mentally. You would probably kill yourself. Do you see now what I mean by how cruel these boys were? They treated her so awfully. It was more so Cruz than it was Cameron, but it was both of them, and both of them supported each other throughout all of this. After about a month or so of this horrific abuse, Cruz reached out to Kim on MSN and just asked her what she was up to that day. And she said, not much. She had like a free day up until like 3 p.m. when she had to babysit for her mum. And Cruz said, okay, good. I was kind of hoping that you would be free today because I want to hang out and I want to apologize. That was all he said. He wasn't specific in that message about what he wanted to apologize for. We can kind of presume that it's the way that he's been treating her, but he wasn't specific. And Kim was happy to hear this at first. She was happy to receive this message, but then all of a sudden, suspicion starts creeping in, and she's thinking, well, why? Why does he all of a sudden want to apologize? Where has this come from? She told him that. She told him that she couldn't help but feel like this was all a bit sudden, it was coming out of nowhere, and she would feel a lot more comfortable if they could talk on the phone first before they meet up in person. And Cruz said okay, and the two of them had a phone call. So obviously we don't know exactly what was said in this phone call because, well, it wasn't recorded, so we don't have that information. But what we do have is some text messages between Cruz and Cameron, because when Cruz was on the phone to Kim, he secretly, without Kim's knowledge, merged the call with one with Cameron. So now all three of them are on the same phone call, but Kim has no idea that Cameron is now listening in to this very personal conversation that she's about to have with Cruz. So about halfway through this phone call, Cameron and Cruz start messaging, and they're kind of talking about the conversation that's being had out loud on the phone. And because we don't have the context of the actual phone call, these messages can be a little bit confusing, but you can get the general sense of it, and the general sense is that it's very fucking disturbing and gross. Cruz messaged Cameron saying, "I'm gonna rip her nose ring out and burn it. Burn her flesh. I'm not killing her right away." Cameron replied, "Why not keep her bound and alive?" And Cruz responded, "That's what I need to do. But I need to get her stoned first and possibly seduce her." Cameron replied, "Lol, try quickly." They decided that they were going to murder Kimberly Proctor. And I don't know who the first one was to mention this. I don't know if it was mentioned previously in person, but this is the first mention of it that we have in this case. They decided that both of them would be present for the murder, but it would be Cruz that initiated it. He was going to decide when they were ready, and he was going to be the one to say the code phrase. This code phrase, as soon as it was uttered, that was both of the boys' signal to start killing their friend Kim. This code phrase was, "I'm gonna make some KD." KD is short for Kraft Mac and Cheese Dinner in Canada. So that was the code word. "I'm gonna make some KD" was when they were gonna snap into action and murder their friend. In the messages, the boys went on to discuss the idea of robbing her, maybe. I think it was Cameron that was the one that suggested this. Like, if she has anything on her, we should rob her, we should take everything. So, on their phone call, Kim and Cruz agreed to meet up on the morning of March 18th, 2010. They planned to just talk things out, talk about their issues, and maybe come to some resolve. But little did Kim know, that wasn't what Cruz was planning to do at all. She told him that she would have to be home for 3 o'clock because she was babysitting for her mum, and he said that's absolutely fine, like he just wanted to talk to her, so it'd only take the morning. So the three of them all got the bus to Langford Bus Exchange, and they all met up there, and then they decided to walk back to Cruz's house. Almost immediately after arriving in the empty home, the boys put this evil plan into action. The code phrase was said, and suddenly Kim's best friends turned on her. They grabbed her, they started pushing her around, taunting her. One of them grabbed some ties and started tying up her wrists and her ankles, binding her up. They then grabbed a ball of socks, stuffed it into Kimberly's mouth, and then put duct tape over the top of it to gag her. So now she couldn't scream, she couldn't do or say anything. And now that Kimberly wouldn't be able to alert for help, the boys got even worse. They started beating her, punching her, kicking her, slapping her, doing absolutely anything they could to cause harm to her. They just wanted to see her in pain. They were using her like a punching bag. They were experimenting with all different types of torture. One of them grabbed a knife and started mutilating her. They were inserting different things inside of her vagina and her anus, literally things out of the garbage. One of them was like an old lollipop. The boys then took it in turns raping Kimberly Proctor, her two best friends. And throughout this, as the boys were taking turns with her, in between they would be beating her, shouting awful things at her. This was complete and utter torture. After a good few hours of this, Kimberly was becoming rather unresponsive. I don't think it was unresponsive as much as she was just very weak and she wasn't putting up a fight so much anymore. And that was when the boys grabbed Kim, who is still bound and gagged and tied at the wrists and the ankles. They picked her up, took her into Cruz's garage, and just dumped her inside this big chest freezer. She was still alive, being put into this big freezer and having that lid closed on her. The freezer was on. It was cold in there. She was gagged. She was running out of oxygen very quickly. And when the boys would later open that freezer, they would find Kimberly Proctor dead in there. The lack of oxygen had eventually killed her. I don't know how long it actually took for her to die inside that freezer, but we do know that it will have been quite a long and drawn out death. She did die of asphyxiation from the lack of oxygen around her because she'd had this ball of socks taped in her mouth for hours before she'd even been put in the freezer, so it's hard enough for her to breathe as is. And then she gets put in the freezer and the lid is closed on her. It's airtight in there and no more oxygen got in. At some point during all of this, I don't know if it was while she was in the freezer or once they realized that she was dead, but at some point the boys, more specifically Cruz, started to set up a bit of an alibi, a little bit of a cover for himself. He ran to his computer and logged onto MSN, which is where he and all of his friends usually communicated. And he opened his chat with Kim, a message saying, "Oh, are you done babysitting yet?" He knew full well that she hadn't even made it to babysitting that day, but he was setting this up so that there was some sort of like written evidence that made him look very innocent and unaware. But by doing this, Cruz had actually drawn a bit of attention to himself, because I don't know if any of you remember having MSN, but I remember when someone would log on, you would get a little notification in the corner that was like, "Hey, your friend Cruz is online." And so when he'd logged on to send Kim this message, one of his friends had spotted that he was online and he messaged Cruz, quite a personal message. He wanted advice on something rather like personal. I think something had happened with this kid's dad. And he really like vented to Cruz, but obviously Cruz is dealing with all of this right now, so he doesn't respond to his friend. And so the friend ends up nudging him and being like, "Hello, like, I need that advice, please." And it was at this point that Cruz realized that he was gonna have to like message this friend back, otherwise he would look very suspicious. But the thing that he ends up messaging this friend, you're not gonna believe it, right? He goes, opens the chat with this friend, and he messages saying, "Oh, sorry, I didn't get back to you. The freezer was jumping around," when he has just murdered a girl. It's insane. But it's also just laughable that he's going to a certain extent to try and cover for himself, but then he's also just being so blatant in other messages as if it wasn't going to come back to bite him. And it wasn't just Cruz that was acting weirdly either. Cameron Moffat was also being very odd in the aftermath of the murder. He had messaged, I think, an ex-girlfriend of his or like an old flame and tried to rekindle things that same night after he's just murdered a girl. He has gone back, thought of like his old roster of old girls that he used to talk to. He's picked one out of his head, messaged her out of nowhere, just asking what she was up to. She said that she wasn't doing anything that night, and so Cameron invited her to come to Cruz's house and chill with them two. And this girl actually turned him down. She was like, "Oh no, I can't tonight." And thank God, because we don't know what could have happened to that other girl as well. Were they planning to lure another girl to the house and commit two murders in one day? We have no idea. Other than that, not much else is really known about how the boys spent the rest of that night. You can imagine that a lot of it was just them discussing how they were gonna try and get away with this murder, discussing how they were gonna get rid of Kim's body the next day. That next morning, they grabbed a hockey bag and went into the garage and loaded Kim's body, her frozen dead body, into this hockey bag. The boys then carried this bag to the bus stop and hopped on a bus to the Galloping Goose walking trail with a dead body in a hold all hanging off of their arm. And that is one of the most insane things I've heard in a true crime case. And I know it's not specifically unique to this one. I know that this has happened in a good few cases, but the concept of that makes me feel so uneasy that you could just be on a bus and someone else could get on, you know, just a normal bus customer, and they could like sit down on the seat next to you and have a dead body in their bag, and there is absolutely no way for you to know. You would never know. you would just be sitting next to a dead body and the person that killed them. So they rode the bus out to Galloping Goose Walking Trail, which I think is just like a big like nature reserve. It's just a load of trees, big woodland with like a hiking trail. And the boys ventured well far into Galloping Goose Trail, and they eventually got to a bridge. They decided that this bridge would be quite a good place to leave Kim's body. They went underneath it, so it was a footbridge that people were walking over, and so they thought, well, if they go down under the bridge, then there's no reason for anyone to ever go under there. So they took the bag down there, and literally with Kim's body still inside this hockey bag, they doused it in petrol. Cameron had gone earlier that morning to go and pick up some petrol. They knew what they were doing here. They doused the bag and her body in petrol, and then they set it on fire, thinking and hoping that it would get rid of all of the evidence. And now they would get away with murder. The boys left the Galloping Goose Trail that day thinking that all of the evidence had been taken care of. And they both went to enjoy the rest of their days as if they hadn't just murdered an innocent young girl. Cruz actually went and met up with a girl that has been described in some reports as his girlfriend, which is crazy if he had a girlfriend throughout all of this. And Cameron actually went out for brunch with his mother and his grandmother. How can you face your grandma the day after you have murdered someone? That's insane. Little did the boys know that an investigation was already well underway to find Kim Proctor, because right now she was missing. As soon as she hadn't turned up to a 3 p.m. babysitting appointment, then her mother knew that something was wrong. She tried to call Kimberly and her phone had just gone straight to voicemail, and again, her mother is sensing that something is wrong because Kim's phone never goes to voicemail. She always picks it up. She's a very good girl. She would always make it home for her babysitting commitments. She would always answer her phone. She would always be very communicative with her mother. Communicative? Is that how you say that? I feel like I rushed that word and it just came out like... Point being, her mum knew that something was wrong when she couldn't get hold of Kim, and so she reported her missing to the police literally just a few hours after she would have been murdered. 7 p.m. the following day, so the day when the boys would have dumped her body was actually found later that same day at 7 p.m. It hadn't been there very long. Some teenagers were actually going under that footbridge to go and smoke weed. That was their usual spot. So realistically, if those kids hadn't have been doing that, I don't think the body would have been found for quite a while. Because not many people have a reason to be going under footbridges, do they? I suppose, unless you're doing something illegal. So Kim's body was found the day after she went missing, but it wasn't identified as Kim Proctor. So her family didn't know for quite a while that she'd actually been found and that there was no chance of them getting her back alive. Her body was so badly burned that it was unidentifiable to anyone's eye. They had to wait until they managed to like study the crime scene and then get her body back for an autopsy, and then and only then could they identify her through dental records, and that was when it was identified as Kimberly Proctor's body. Everyone that knew Kim was absolutely horrified to hear of her murder, and I think most people would be, of course, but Kim was such a sweet, innocent, well-behaved, well-mannered girl. She had no enemies. She never made anyone feel any kind of way. She was never mean to anyone. That town where they lived was supposedly so safe and so friendly and a good place to raise a family, but people couldn't believe that something like this had happened in their town, that a young woman had lost her life in such a horrific way. So now that the body had been identified as that of Kim Proctor, the investigation was underway. Police started by questioning absolutely everyone, because everyone at this point was a potential suspect. Family, friends, boyfriend, well, ex-boyfriend, the guy that she was dating a little bit, Cruz, you know, police were looking at everyone. Especially Cruz and Cameron, to be fair, and Zach, because they were her closest circle. And Cameron and Cruz were questioned a number of times by police in the very beginning of this case, both when Kim was just a missing person and then when her body was discovered and it was found to be a murder. These boys were very, very central to the investigation. Whether they were suspects or not, they were still Kim's closest friends and could probably offer some useful
information or evidence.
The two of them told police their alibis. Alibis? I don't know. They hardly really had alibis. Their alibis were that they were at home with family, or they were with their girlfriend, or they were with each other, or I don't know what their alibis were, but they obviously couldn't be proven. They did, however, admit to the police that they had seen Kim that day. They'd been with her that morning, but they also said that she left as normal for her babysitting commitment at 3 p.m. They said that she had fully intended on making it there. So something must have happened to her between being with them and making her way to babysitting. Now, police never really fully accepted Cruz and Cameron's alibis or their stories or their versions of events. I mean, they kind of had to a degree, because they couldn't disprove anything. They had no proof of absolutely anything right now. But something wasn't right. Police were just keeping an eye on these two. You know, they were gonna keep them at the front of their mind. Almost a week went by after Kim's murder, and it seemed that the boys were getting away with it. That's how it looked right now anyway, because the police weren't overly onto them, or at least it didn't seem like that to the boys. In fact, Cameron was even eager to do it again, which makes me think that he was probably trying to kill his ex-girlfriend that night, inviting her over to the house, because a week after Kim's murder, Cameron messaged Cruz saying, "Since we killed that bitch and it wasn't so hard, we should do it again." So, in the aftermath of the murder, the boys are trying to keep it cool, act cool, you know, don't act suspicious, don't act weird. But they're actually doing the opposite of that. They're actually acting really weird, especially Cruz. Whenever Kim was brought up in school, Cruz would get really weird about it and say some really horrible shit. He'd say such awful and insensitive things. He'd be like, "Oh, who cares? She's dead anyway." And stuff like that. Like, this is your best friend, one of your best friends. But it wouldn't be long until police finally caught up with the boys, thanks to a very stupid choice from Cruz. By now, police were onto both of them sufficiently. They had bugged both of their houses, bugged both their phones, their computers. They were watching their every move. And the boys were blissfully unaware that they were being so intently watched, and they were behaving as normal, which would eventually be their downfall. Now, for context for this next bit, for Cruz's big F up, you need a little bit of pre-context. So he had a girlfriend, or like an e-girlfriend. I don't know what Cruz's romantic situation was throughout this case. I don't know if he had multiple girls on the go at once, or I really don't know, but basically, there was this girl that lived quite a way away. She lived in Canada, but like long distance, good few hours away. So the two of them would talk online a lot. That was where most of their relationship took place. But on one particular night, Cruz messaged his e-girlfriend and he was like, "I have something to tell you, but I'm a bit nervous." And she's like, "Oh no, tell me, you can tell me whatever." And he was like, "Okay, I can tell you, but I will only tell you through the World of Warcraft messaging feature." And she was like, "Okay, see you there." So he redirected the conversation from whatever platform they were on at the time to World of Warcraft messaging. And I believe he did this because he thought that messaging through the World of Warcraft servers might be harder to trace and connect to him than, you know, texting his girlfriend from his number that is signed up to his name and everything. He just thought that this was putting a bit more of a barrier between him and the police, because he was about to admit to some shit to his girlfriend. He gave this girl a detailed confession, including links to articles about the murder of Kim Proctor that him and his friend committed. And he gave this girl all these kind of like inside pieces of information that hadn't been posted in these articles. He was going into detail, telling his girlfriend how he had murdered another girl. And her response was shockingly or unshockingly quite supportive. She said to him, she was like, "Look, thank you for telling me this. I'm sticking by your side no matter what. Like, we'll get through this together." Whether she meant that or not, we don't know. But as I mentioned earlier in the case, sometimes women just have to lie to men because they're scared of them. That is very common. So maybe she was just putting on a bit of a front and being like, "Oh, don't worry, like, I'll stay with you." I don't know if she ever went to the police about any of this, but truth be told, she didn't really need to, because because it wouldn't be long until police got hold of those messages from World of Warcraft. And then they had a full written confession from Cruz. On June 18th, 2010, exactly 3 months after Kimberly Proctor's murder, both of her killers were arrested. Both of the boys stayed quiet at first. They were interrogated for hours by the police, and they were talking, but they were only telling them the things that they'd already said. They weren't giving over anything new. They were sticking to their stories. At one point during his interrogation, Cameron Moffat even said to the police, and this is so cocky, it's unreal. He said to the police, "I'm telling you the truth. I'm just not telling you every single little thing down to the tiniest grain of detail." So he's being like, there is some things I'm withholding, but I'm telling you the truth. Like, what a dickhead. But eventually, after 9 hours of interrogation, Cameron Moffat cracked and started to confess in detail what had really gone down that day. When he was asked about the aftermath of Kim's murder and taking her body to the woods and burning it, Cameron said that he knew burning her body wasn't going to get rid of everything, like there was going to be bones left and bits like that, bits that could identify her. But he said that by lighting the fire, he hoped that other pieces of evidence could be gotten rid of, you know, like bruises and signs of the torture and the beatings on her body, and, you know, any DNA of the boys that might have ended on her, you know, burning her body would get rid of that. Eventually, police felt that they had enough evidence to charge both of these boys with the murder. So they were charged, and then they were put in a van to be transported to, I don't know, wherever they were going to be kept. And the boys didn't know that the van was also bugged. So they've already been charged with the murders, but police are still trying to get any last little bits of evidence, you know, in case they need to take it to trial. So the van was bugged, and they recorded Cameron and Cruz's conversation. Cruz was telling Cameron all about his interrogations with the police, saying, "They were really trying to stroke my ego, tell me how smart they think I am, and oh, you're so good at manipulating," and things like that. The boys were just poking fun at the whole situation. They felt very proud, you know, like obviously the police were saying all of that just to stroke their egos, just to butter them up, just to, you know, get on their good side. And the boys knew that, but they didn't really care, because at the end of the day, they were still being told that they were smart and good at manipulating, and that was good enough for them. So now they're sat in the back of this van, like, bragging about it to each other, being like, "They told me I was good at manipulating." I imagine that's exactly how they were saying it as well. Cameron said back to Cruz, so it was Cruz that told Cameron that other quote from before, and then Cameron said back to Cruz, "I just laughed at, like, half the things they said and sat there with a big-ass grin on my face." Let me remind you, these are the interrogations for their best friend's murder. So now, in this case, all that was left for police to do was to, like, consolidate all of their evidence and make sure that they've got absolutely everything against these boys. And that was when they found something else. Because they'd obviously been going back and back and back through the boys' search histories and all of their internet activity. Like, they'd been going back years as they were, like, getting all the evidence for this case. And eventually, they found something way back in Cruz's internet history that is just insane. I know I use that word a lot in this case, but everything's pretty insane here. Just over a year before he would go on to commit the murder, Cruz posted a WordPress blog titled "Early Warning Signs of a Serial Killer." In this post, he, like, lists all these early warning signs of a serial killer, of course, and that includes animal abuse, fascination with fire, abandonment from at least one parent, there'll be a major interest in, like, BDSM and hardcore pornography and, like, violent sex. And Cruz ended this whole article where he's gone through all these early signs of a serial killer. He ends it with, "The peculiar thing is, I meet all 14 criteria of a psychopath. Apparently, though, meeting all criteria makes it unlikely for the subject to be a serial killer. I suppose only time will tell." He ended the post saying, "Only time will tell." And I truly believe that had these boys not been caught for Kim Proctor's murder, they definitely would have acted again. And had they not been caught for that one, they would have acted again and become serial killers. This type of sadism is incurable, and it continues throughout someone's life, when they have such little respect for other people and for other people's lives, then yeah, these boys should be locked away forever. When the case went to trial, both Cruz Wellwood and Cameron Moffat pled guilty to their charges of murder and for burning Kim's body. The two of them got life in prison with a minimum of 10 years before they're eligible for parole, and that 10 years has already been and gone, so they could be released on parole any fucking day now. Neither of them have been just yet, but they are actively having hearings every so often from now on. So Kimberly's family were pretty upset that they couldn't seek the death penalty for these boys, because they fully felt that if these boys have taken my daughter's life, then they don't deserve to have their own. Although the death penalty isn't offered in Canada, so that wasn't going to be an option. But Kimberly's family were still very vocal that they felt that these boys should pay with their lives. They both seemed to lack empathy to such a terrifying degree. Like, they felt none in the run-up to the murder, none while it was happening, none in the aftermath. Like, there was not a single emotion that went through these boys. People like that are the ones that are most likely to become serial killers. And like I say, if they hadn't been caught, I have no doubt that that's exactly what Cameron and Cruz would have gone on to be, because I think that's what they wanted to be. In the aftermath of this case, a few girls actually came forward to officials saying that Cameron or Cruz, or in some cases even both of them, had sexually assaulted them, or just assaulted them in some way or another, been violent or aggressive or abusive towards them. These boys had a pattern. Kim wasn't their first victim, but she was their first murder victim. A ton of other girls said that they had either been raped or sexually assaulted or coerced or forced into really violent sex with these two boys. Both of them, Cameron and Cruz, have since been diagnosed as psychopaths and sexual sadists. And still to this day, like I said, they're both in prison, but they can have parole hearings from this point, so it's scary. Their regular assessments still to this day say that both of them are still at high risk of reoffending. So if that's still happening, if they're still having these assessments and they're still coming back with the same answer, hopefully that is enough to not let them be let out on parole. They've both been denied parole multiple times for that exact reason, and especially Cruz has quite a low chance of being let out on parole because he is still having outbursts in prison. And I don't know the exact nature of these outbursts, but I think he harms himself during these outbursts. I don't think he's harmed anyone else in prison, but it's clear that he can't manage his own emotions and needs a lot of help there before they can even consider letting him out. Thank you so much for listening to Usual Disclaimer. At this point, I just want to say that if you've been affected by any of the topics we discussed today, please check the description where we've left some helpful resources. If you want to hear more cases like this one, make sure to follow Usual Disclaimer on your podcast app so that you get notifications when we post new episodes. And if you really enjoyed, I'd love it if you could leave a rating and a review too. Usual Disclaimer with Ellen O'Neill is an Audio Boom Studios production. See you next time.